Turn to Proverbs 7:14. So we're still talking about strange woman. And in verse 13, if you'll remember from last time, it says, "So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him." And now we are going to get to the first thing that she says. These are the first words that she utters to this young man. And she says, "I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows." So we saw last time that she catches him and aggressively kisses him like a slut, as we saw from the definition of the word. And now she tries to shamelessly feign religion to deceive the young man to think that she's actually a good woman. Now, this shouldn't have worked just based on her previous action and attire, which we'll look at here in a second. But, you know, people do this, and you want to beware of people that try to hide their sin under a cloak of religion. And there's plenty of people that do it. There's most of these guys on television, the televangelists, they figured out a good way to make a lot of money under the cloak of religion. And there's a lot of people, a lot of evil people that go to church at least every once in a while, and they claim to be a part of a religion. Most of the presidents have claimed to be Christian. I think probably all of them have, right? And a lot of the people that do really terrible things in this world do so under the cloak of religion. Think about all the things the Catholic Church has done, all the persecution and then all the abuse, all the things they've done under all these priests under the name of religion. And so this is nothing new, and this is exactly what this woman is trying to do. And that's why it's so important that we know people by their fruits, not just by what they say. So let's just look at a couple of verses here that tell us that we should examine what people do, not so much what they say. Matthew 7 and verse 20 is the first one. But what people say is important too, but as the old saying goes, talk is cheap. People can talk a good talk. Probably just about anybody can figure out how to say, "I love God. I trust God, right? God is so good to me," right? Things like that. I mean, anybody, nobody, you don't need grace. You don't need anything. You just need to be around Christianity for about 10 seconds and you can figure out how to say that. So just things like that aren't quite enough. Matthew 7 and verse 20, Jesus is talking about false prophets. And he says, "Wherefore by their fruits ye shall know them." If you walk up to a tree and you see certain fruit on it, and if it's red and has kind of a hard, edible outside exterior to it, you can probably figure that, oh, that's an apple tree, right? You know the tree by its fruit. Or if you see oranges on it, it's an orange tree, right? You wouldn't expect to see almonds on a grapefruit tree, right? So you'll know the tree by its fruit. So as Christians, we should be fruit inspectors. We should, you know, take a look at how somebody lives and then by that determine whether we trust that they are a genuine believer or not. Now look at Matthew 12 and verses 33 through 35. Jesus said, "Either make the tree good and his fruit good, or else make the tree corrupt and his fruit corrupt, for a tree is known by his fruit. O generation of vipers, how can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh." See, these people, they don't even have good words or good fruits, because what's in their heart is coming out. And if you listen to somebody long enough, even if they do sound godly, you keep listening, and you listen whenever they don't think another believer's listening, or when they're not in front of other people, they don't realize that other people are hearing what they're saying, then hear what they say, and that might tip you off as well. "A good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth good things, and an evil man out of the evil treasure bringeth forth evil things." So that's how we identify people by their fruits, not just by their words, because words are deceptive. Look at 2 Peter 2 and verse 3. But really, it's the same thing with fruits and words. Both of those things can be feigned. Remember Judas Iscariot. He was a philanthropist. He was indignant about the fact that this woman took this ointment and anointed Jesus' feet with it, and it could have been sold for 300 pence and given to the poor, right? He was using this cloak of piety to hide his covetousness, because they said later in another place that he said this, or maybe in the same place, he said this because he was a thief and he had the bag. So he wanted that 300 pence because he could take care of himself, not the poor with it. And a lot of that goes on as well. So you got to examine what people say and do, and then keep examining, because sometimes they can trick you for a while. 2 Peter 2 and verse 3. And through covetousness shall they with feigned words are fake words, right? Paul said that Timothy had an unfeigned faith, an unpretended faith, not a fake faith, but a real, genuine, true faith. But these people with feigned words, with pretended words, make merchandise of you, whose judgment now of a long time lingereth not, and their damnation slumbereth not. And that's a really good description of these televangelists. Feigned words make merchandise of you. They make a lot of money off of unsuspecting people. A lot of old ladies, as a matter of fact. Probably old ladies get swindled more by these televangelists than anybody else. And it's just terrible. And that's what they do, though, with the feigned words. And then down in verse 18, it says, "For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through much wantonness, those that were clean escaped from them who live in error." Now, this really matches up with what the strange woman is doing here. She, through great swelling words of vanity, as we'll see, she allures through much wantonness, which is like lust, you know, sexual lust kind of thing. So that's how she allures the young man with these good words and fair speeches and her attractive appeal. So he should have been paying attention to not just what she said, but how she dressed, what she did. And he didn't. He was deceived by her, as we will see as we go through this. So she says there, "I have peace offerings with me." Now, peace offerings were a part of the religious service of the Jews. And we can see that back in Leviticus 7 and verse 11. This probably wouldn't mean a whole lot to people today. If you're very familiar with the Old Testament law, then peace offering might bring you something to mind. But today, if somebody came up to you and said, "I have peace offerings with me," you'd be like, "What's that mean?" Right? And you know, it's really not kind of a strange pickup line, right? I've never had a woman come up to me and say, "I have peace offerings with me. This day have I paid my vows." I never used that one either. Probably wouldn't have got you too far. But a Jew in the Old Testament would have known exactly what this was referring to. Because remember, they are right outside Solomon's castle. They're right in Jerusalem, which is the heart and soul of Israel and its religion, right where the temple was. Leviticus 7 and verse 11, it says, "And this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings, which he shall offer unto the Lord." Now, I'll get into the peace offering itself here in a little bit, but I just wanted to show you that this is part of the law of Moses, the law of the peace offering. Now, this was said, as far as I can tell, to convey two things, at least. These two things would have been conveyed by that statement, "I have peace offerings with me." First of all, it implied that she was religious. She's a keeper of the law of Moses, because that's what the peace offering was all about. It was made in the temple, right? So clearly she's religious. Secondly, it would have indicated that she was well off because she had the means to offer a beast as a peace offering, and we'll talk about that more in a little bit. But part of the peace offering was a beast, an ox or a sheep, a large beast, which were not exactly cheap. You remember Jesus' mother, when she gave birth to him, and then she went in and made the offering in the temple, and she offered a pigeon or a turtle dove, and that was the offering of the poor. So poor people offered those little birds. People with wealth would offer the larger animal. And the peace offering, unless I missed something, and maybe there was other animals for the peace offering, but the ones that I was reading about here were the larger animals. So it would indicate that she was a little better off. And we'll talk about that here in a second. So these two things would make the young man think that she was a decent woman and not a whore, right? She's religious, and she's pretty well off. She's got her own place. Chances are she's not a harlot, right? That's probably maybe what he was thinking. Or maybe he just saw her attire, and she started talking to him, and he wasn't thinking at all. And that's a possibility as well. Now notice something else. She says, "I have peace offerings with me." That's interesting. She has them with her. Now, does that mean she's carrying them in her purse with her? It wouldn't mean that, but it does mean she has them in her possession. Now, why would she have peace offerings with her? That's kind of interesting, because after all, the peace offerings were made at the temple, right? The sacrifices were made at the temple, so why would they be with her? Well, turn with me to verse 9 in Proverbs 7, and this little piece of information will help to shed a little bit of light on it. Proverbs 7 and verse 9. Proverbs 7, 9 says, in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. So they're meeting in the evening. It's nighttime. She's got peace offerings with her. She said, this day, there in this verse we're looking at in 14, this day have I paid my vows. So she had paid vows that day, and then that evening, that night, she's got peace offerings with her. This is, actually makes good sense, as we'll see here. So the peace offerings that she had with her would have been what was left over from the sacrifice that she had taken back to her house. And this is what they did with the peace offering. Part of the peace offering would go to the Lord, part of it would go to the priest, and the remainder of it went back with the worshiper back home to be eaten either that day. In some cases, it was that day. In some cases, if it was attached to a vow, it could be eaten the next day, but not the day after that. So she's got this fresh meat with her at her house, which, you know, sounds pretty good. Hey, you want to come and have some beef? You want to have a rack of lamb? I've got this peace offering with me. But let me just show you. I just told you, but let me show you that part of the peace offering went to the Lord. Leviticus chapter 7. Should have had you keep your finger there. Leviticus 7 and verse 31. I'm going to tie a few verses here together, but we're going to see that the fat was the Lord's. Thank the Lord we don't live under the Old Testament anymore. They couldn't eat fat. The Lord got all the fat. Under the New Testament, we can eat all the fat we want, which is the best part of the meat, if you ask me, anyway. So the Lord got the fat. He got the kidneys, which, you know, I would have no problem with that. The caul and the rump of the sheep. And the rump would have been a, you know, good part of the sheep as well. Leviticus 7 and verse 31. It says, and the priest shall burn the fat upon the altar, and the breast shall be Aaron's and his sons'. So I wanted the first part of that. We'll get to the second part later. But the priest would burn the fat upon the altar. And if you compare that with Leviticus chapter 3 and verse 16, it says, and the priest shall burn them upon the altar. It is the food of the offering made by fire for a sweet savor. All the fat is the Lord's. So the fat that they burnt there on the altar was the Lord's. It got burnt up, and its smoke ascends to heaven. It's a sweet smelling savor in God's nose. And then, I shouldn't have turned, in Leviticus 3, 3 through 5, we see here some other parts that were the Lord's as well. And this is referring to the peace offering. You can see that in verse 1. And if his oblation be a sacrifice of peace offering, then he goes on talking about if it's offered from the herd and so on. And then down in verse 3, it says, and he shall offer of the sacrifice of the peace offering an offering made by fire unto the Lord, the fat that covereth the inwards, and all the fat that is upon the inwards, and the two kidneys, and the fat that is on them, which is by the flanks, and the caul above the liver, with the kidneys, it shall he take away. And Aaron's son shall burn it on the altar of, or upon the burnt sacrifice, which is upon the wood that is on the fire. It is an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto the Lord. So the Lord here, according to this, gets the fat around the inwards, he gets the kidneys, he gets the fat on the kidneys, he gets the flanks, by the flanks, he gets the caul above the liver, he gets the kidneys. So those parts were the Lord's. And then down in verses 9 through 11, it says, and he shall offer of the sacrifice of the peace offering an offering made by fire unto the Lord, the fat thereof, and the whole rump. So there's the next part that he gets, the rump, the back end of it. It shall he take off hard by the backbone, and the fat that covereth the inwards, and all the fat that is upon the inwards, and the two kidneys, and the fat that is upon them, which is by the flanks, and the caul above the liver, with the kidneys, it shall he take away, and the priest shall burn it upon the altar. It is the food of the offering made by fire unto the Lord. So all that stuff went to the Lord. And then the priests got their part, which was the breast and the right shoulder in Leviticus 7, 14. I think this is somewhat interesting. It doesn't apply to us today, but it is just interesting to see how the sacrifices were made and why this woman has peace offerings with her. And knowing her and her character, she might have just swiped some of it and taken it home anyway when she wasn't supposed to, but I don't think that's what's going on here. Leviticus 7 and verse 14, it says, "And of it he shall offer one out of the whole oblation," which is a sacrifice, another word for sacrifice, "for an heave offering unto the Lord, and it shall be the priests that sprinkleth the blood of the peace offerings, and the flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offerings for thanksgiving shall be eaten the same day that it is offered. He shall not leave any of it until the morning." Actually, I wanted to get to that verse later, but that's okay. And then down in verses 31 through 34. So you saw there the priest. This part that was offered there would be the priests, and he would eat it. And then in verses 31 through 34, it says, "And the priest shall burn the fat upon the altar, but the breast shall be Aaron's and his sons'." See, the fat was the Lord's, so it gets burned up, but the breast belongs to Aaron and his sons, and they can eat it. "And the right shoulder shall ye give unto the priest for an heave offering of the sacrifices of your peace offerings. He among the sons of Aaron that offereth the blood of the peace offerings and the fat shall have the right shoulder for his part. For the wave breast and the heave shoulder have I taken of the children of Israel from off the sacrifices of their peace offerings, and have given them unto Aaron the priest and unto his sons by a statute forever from among the children of Israel." So part of what they offered to the Lord was given to the priests for the priests' maintenance. They could eat that for themselves. The wave breast and the heave shoulder. That's what it was called, right? Yeah, wave breast and heave shoulder.
They don't have to eat it on the same day.
They were supposed to eat... I think they were supposed to eat it on the same day. Yeah, in verse 15. "The flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offering for thanksgiving shall be eaten the same day that it was offered." He would leave none of it till the morning. But part of it could be taken home, especially if there was a vow attached to it, in verse 16. Leviticus 7:16. "But if the sacrifice of his offering be a vow or a voluntary offering, it shall be eaten the same day that he offereth his sacrifice, and on the morrow also the remainder of it shall be eaten." So I take from that on the morrow it's taken home, and the worshiper is eating it. Which is why I think she has the peace offering with her, is how it makes sense to me, anyway. So this might have been an excuse to welcome him into her house. Because, you know, you want a dinner? I mean, I've got this peace offering here. There are actually whores out there, believe it or not, especially married ones, that actually will buy men with gifts. You say, well, that sounds crazy. Well, I have a verse for you. Ezekiel 16, 31 through 33. I don't know how often this happens, but I know that it happened at least once because the Lord was condemning Israel for it. Ezekiel 16, 31 through 33. The Lord says, "In that thou buildest thine eminent place in the head of every way, and makest thine high place in every street, and hast not been an harlot, in that thou scornest Tyre, but as a wife that committeth adultery, which taketh strangers instead of her husband." Well, she's not a harlot. She's not getting paid for her work. She's just an adulteress. She's just taking strangers in for nothing. As a matter of fact, she's paying them. Verse 33, "They give gifts to all whores, but thou givest thy gifts to all thy lovers, and hirest them that they may come unto thee on every side for thy whoredom." So it's kind of a reverse situation here with Israel. She was actually paying them. And the Lord's probably speaking spiritually here also. But you get the point, right? He's not making this point because something like this couldn't happen, obviously. There would be women that would do that. And this woman is pretty well doing that. Hey, she's alluring him with food. They say food is the way to a man's stomach, or the way to a man's heart. Yeah, his heart is, yeah, through his, there you go. Food is the way, yeah. Yeah, the way to his heart is through his stomach, there you go. And then she says, "This day have I paid my vows." Now, paying and making vows was also a part of the religious service of the Jews. And a vow often accompanied the peace offering. Look back in Leviticus chapter 7 again. Leviticus 7:16. Which we already looked at, right? If the sacrifice of his offering be a vow or a voluntary offering, it should be eaten the same day. And this is the chapter talking about the peace offering. So the vow went along with that. You would make a vow and then go make a peace offering, and that would be the accomplishing of the vow. To accomplish means to fulfill, perform, or carry out the vow that was made. And we can see that in Leviticus 22 and verse 21. Leviticus 22, 21. It says, "And whosoever offereth a sacrifice of peace offerings unto the Lord to accomplish his vow, or a free will offering in beeves or sheep, it shall be perfect to be accepted. There shall be no blemish therein." So the sacrifice of the peace offering accomplished the vow. So you made the vow to the Lord, and then to fulfill and carry out that vow and to finish it, you went and made the offering of the peace offering, and that was the completion of the vow. Kind of like with the vow of the Nazarite, he would shave off his hair and burn the hair. And that would be, and he made, I think he made an offering as well, if I remember right. I think it's in Numbers chapter 6, if I remember. But anyway, that was the accomplishing of the vow of the Nazarite. This would be the accomplishing of the vow with a peace offering attached to it. Now, paying a vow to God is a serious matter. In Ecclesiastes 5 and verses 4 through 5, Solomon tells us important nature of this. Ecclesiastes 5, 4 through 5. He said, "When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better it is that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay." So you want to be really careful if you make a vow to God that you pay it. You don't tell the Lord, "I'm going to do something," and then don't do it. Right, Lord, if you spare my job, I'm going to come to Bible study every night, or whatever. Right, whatever you say you're going to do, you keep that vow. My Uncle Carl, who's the preacher, and this is commendable. It's pretty wild. When he was in college, he wanted to get back home for Christmas. Of course, he was doing that, still does. But anyway. He wanted to get home for Christmas. He was down in Texas. He was from Pennsylvania, where I am. And he made a vow or a promise to God that if God would get him somehow home for Christmas, then he would give 20% of his gross income for the rest of his life to the Lord. And guess what? He's darn near 70 years old now, and he gives 20% of his gross income to the Lord and has his entire life, even when he raised 5 kids, one of them in a wheelchair and all that. And he's done that his whole life. Because he told God he would. So, he's got character. Yeah. I'll tell you that. And when you vow a vow to God, don't defer to pay it. He's got no pleasure in fools. So, obviously, when she says today, this day I've paid my vows, that means that she's, or well, that's implying anyway, that she's a godly woman, right? She's made a vow. She's kept the vow. She's, right? She's doing what God says to do. If you look in Psalm 116, 12 through 19, Psalm 116, 12 through 19, it says, "What shall I render unto the Lord for all his benefits toward me? I will take the cup of salvation and call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all his people. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. O Lord, truly I am thy servant. I am thy servant and the son of thine handmaid. Thou hast loosed my bonds. I will offer to thee the sacrifice of thanksgiving. I will call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all his people. In the courts of the Lord's house, in the midst of thee, O Jerusalem, praise ye the Lord." So when you pay your vows, I mean, you're doing a godly thing. You're doing it in the presence of all of God's people. You're going to the temple, right? This would imply that she's quite the religious woman, that she's paid her vows that day. She said she'd paid her vows that day. So she had been to worship at the temple earlier that day. This is probably on a Saturday. She'd probably been to the temple on Sabbath. And then now it's Saturday evening. She wasn't, I mean, this makes perfect sense. You're not supposed to work on the Sabbath day. She waited until the evening, till the black and dark night, till Sabbath was over to go to work. Right? That's what she's doing, right? She's going to work after the Sabbath. See, she's a godly woman. I mean, everything matches up here. This woman is a saint. She won't even work on the Sabbath. So this should remind us that it's not only the people that profess to be Christians who are often deceivers, but also those who are regular churchgoers. Right? So just because you meet somebody out there and he goes to church every Sunday doesn't necessarily mean that he's a good guy, that he's a child of God, that he's sincere. There's lots of people that go to church every Sunday because business benefits they can get from it, they look good in the community, that, you know, who knows what? Who knows what their motivation is, but there's plenty of people that do that. This woman did too, apparently. These types of people creep into churches unawares and they turn the grace of God into lasciviousness, which is precisely what this woman's doing. Look at Jude 1 and verse 4. Jude 1 and verse 4. It says, "For there are certain men crept in unawares, who were before of old ordained to this condemnation, ungodly men, turning the grace of our God into lasciviousness, and denying the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ." Lasciviousness is the quality of being lascivious, and lascivious is inclined to lust, lewd, or wanton. Fornicators are lascivious. People that are don't control their sexual lust and passions. Are lascivious, like this woman, turning the grace of God into lasciviousness. Here she is pretending to be a worshiper of God and using that very thing to accomplish her lasciviousness. I think that's pretty interesting. So if this young man had any discernment at all, he would have known that a woman dressed like a harlot on a street corner at night is not a godly, virtuous woman, no matter how religious she may sound. But you know, chances are he was probably overlooking all that stuff, and like a lot of us, he saw what he wanted to see, and he overlooked everything that he didn't want to see. Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches to see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.